listen to oral argument. The students are provided with materials about the case they're about to hear and may have had counsel in to talk with them about the case. So we now welcome Heritage Christian School. With those students, please stand. We're delighted to have you. You may be seated. And we have Lancaster School. Would they stand, please? And a welcome to you also. You may be seated. Well, now that we've met you, I'd like to introduce the court to all of you. On my far left is Justice Diana Sykes. Next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. Seated to my immediate left is Justice John Wilcox. I am Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice William Babbage, and to his right, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and on the far right, Justice David Prosser. With those introductions made, I'll just tell the Heritage Christian School and the Lancaster School that you will remain after this argument, please, and you will be joined by the New Glarus Christian School and Home, which are homeschooled young people, and you will all be meeting with Justice Diane Sykes and anyone else here who would like to attend that session. Is welcome. We'll talk about the procedures of the court. We are now ready to proceed with the case, which is 98-0250, Joan German versus the Wisconsin Department of Transportation. Representing the Department of Transportation is Richard Moriarty, Assistant Attorney General. Counsel?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm Richard Browse Moriarty, representing the defendants' appellants. May it please the court. Plaintiff's claims should not be in court at all. Why? The major reason, as you may expect, is the state's immunity. But the first reason these claims should not be in court is that the legislature built a different road for the pursuit of these claims. The legislature directed employees who believed their hours of work were calculated incorrectly to file complaints with the Department of Workforce Development under the Hours of Work and Overtime Act. If employees think that their lunch breaks should, under the Hours of Work and Overtime regulation, be work time, they can ask that department to exercise its expertise on those issues and determine whether the time they spend eating their lunches should be work time. If plaintiffs had filed their lunch break claims with the Department of Workforce Development and prevailed, they may only have received compensatory time, not any back wages. Regardless, those claims would have been resolved long ago in the way intended by the legislature, and both the state and the plaintiffs could have moved on to other matters. Instead, plaintiffs ignored the road designated by the legislature and traveled off-road with their claims, trying to find a way to legitimately pursue them in court.
Why would they do that, Counsel?
I can't answer that for you, Your Honor. I have asked the question in a number of briefs, and I've never heard an articulated answer. Why the plaintiffs have chosen to pursue this matter in court, their claims in court, despite the state's immunity, when they have always had the opportunity of going to the Department of Workforce Development.
Counsel, 109.035 says, an employee may bring an action against an employer under this subsection without first filing a wage claim with the department. Seems to me that the statute specifically says, come here, come to court.
I'm sorry.
You don't have to go.
I was just grabbing the statute. Could you have that?
Sure. We're under 109.03, aren't we?
Yes.
And we're under subsection 5.
Correct.
Enforcement. It says, an employee may bring an action against an employer under this subsection without first filing a wage claim with the department.
Correct.
Five of them might say, hey, the statute specifically says, come here.
Because
and it says employee means a person employed by an employer. And what does employer mean? Does that mean
includes the state,
Your Honor.
Includes the state.
So it seems to me
if we
right
look at,
where we should be.
If we look at the sentence just before the one you were citing in
109.03
right. sub 5, each employee shall have a right of action against any employer for the full amount
right.
of the employee's wages due on each regular payday, as provided in this section, etc., the increased wages. The purpose here, as every court decision that has looked at this statute has concluded, the purpose is to assure prompt payment of wages that are actually due, not to resolve wage disputes such as the one plaintiffs are pursuing
here. But if
here.
It's actually due and it's not in dispute, why would you have to go to court?
Because the legislature recognized the evil that employers were engaging in of having an obligation to pay a particular set of wages and not paying those paychecks promptly. That's what the original part of it was, going back to the 1898 statutes all the way through.
Okay, but now give me an example of a case that you think that let's leave out the state immunity issue.
Sure.
Give me an example of a case that you think could be brought under this section.
Under the wage claim statute.
Yeah.
I have a paycheck coming every 2 weeks. It's a set paycheck. I know what it's going to be. The state refuses to send me my paycheck, just refuses to give it to me. And they do that for several, they don't have to do it for more than one paycheck, but they do it for several paychecks. I have a right to go to court and say, wait a minute, you are obligated to give me that paycheck.
Right.
There's no dispute whatsoever, but you're just not issuing it.
So what does the state say in defense?
What the state says in defense is probably maybe we better settle this thing, hopefully, but who knows what they'll say.
But what if the state says we don't owe it to you? Or if the employee says, our employer says, we don't owe it to you. Now you've got a wage dispute, right?
Not about the wage, not about the amount that is due.
Yeah, well, that's my point of my questioning,
okay.
And Justice Babbitt got right to the heart of it, which is that as soon as the defendant says, I don't owe it to you, I don't owe you that much, or I don't owe it to you on that date, or anything else, you got a wage dispute, and under your reasoning, it can't go to court. So the only cases that can go to court under your reasoning is if the defendant comes in, the employer comes in and says, sure, I owe it to you. Is it a default judgment case or a case where there's just nothing?
If the employer comes in and says, oh, no, that wasn't owed at all to you, then that will get thrashed out under the situation. But there's a distinction here between what the plaintiffs are trying to do, which is to come in and say, you know, you should have been putting us in our lunch breaks into the work time when you were calculating the time. You should have been doing that, and you didn't. And the reasons you should have been doing that is this whole 12-factor test, and if every one of those factors is met, then by golly, it should be work time. Then, if they're right about that, maybe you get wages, maybe you don't. You might get just compensatory time. There is no way that the plaintiffs can say these wages were due on a particular date and not paid, actually due under the statute and not paid promptly. What they're saying is, we've got a dispute, it needs to get resolved, we want the court to resolve it, and then impose appropriate
damages.
What
do they have a dispute about, counsel? What's the dispute about?
The dispute is about whether or not troopers, when they are eating their lunch, are going to have that time period deemed work time, and if so, what damages result?
Sounds like a wage claim to me.
Well, just then, with that broad interpretation of the word wage claim, just as I've been discriminated against based on gender in the calculation of my pay, I've proved it. Now what do? I get back pay. That's covered by the Fair Employment Statute. It's not a wage claim for wages actually due that haven't been paid promptly. It's a claim under the Fair Employment Act.
Does the Fair Employment Act have similar language here where it says each employee shall have a right of action against an employer for the full amount of wages due, and you don't have to go to the administrative agency? Does that have similar language under 111?
The Fair Employment Act does not have that language, and the Hours of Work Act doesn't have that kind of language. Both of those two statutes create alternative agency schemes, comprehensive in and of themselves, for handling those wage disputes. That's what the legislature directed employees towards. And in the event, for example, plaintiffs had gone to the department, and the department issued an order in their favor and not only found they were entitled to lunch breaks, but also found they should be paid a particular amount of money in wages. Now those wages have become due. They're told you must pay those by a certain date, and the state failed to do that. Then they could pursue this action under 109, because then they're not doing something they should have been doing, and the evil that this statute is directed towards, bolstered by lien and penalty provisions, immediate lien provisions on all of the property of the employer, and penalty provisions for non-payment that accrue daily. That's the type of thing that we have. That's what the department pursues, that the penalties accrue daily. It's the doubling of the a percentage that comes in as penalty. But those are the type of things that the legislature imposes on employers when they are doing something as egregious as not paying a paycheck on time.
But that's with the administrative penalties. What's the penalty if you come to court?
The penalty, if you come to court, the employees can immediately impose a lien on all of the property of the employer and seek penalties. Not just the wages, but penalty wages against the employer.
Where is that?
It's in
the statute.
109.11, I believe.
Yeah, I read that, but it says that's before the department.
In a wage claim, this is 109.11, I'm at Appendix 21 or in my own separate appendix. 109.11, sub 2, civil penalties. In a wage claim commenced by an employee before the department.
Before the department. This isn't before the department. So I don't see that any of this covers. I think there's a criminal penalty if you falsely deny it. But that, I don't know that we're going to hold the state or any assistant attorney general liable under criminal penalties. That should relieve you.
Appreciate it. Is that a bright line earlier?
That's right.
All right. I can't point it to you right now, and I may be in error.
All right. I'll leave that to you. Because, I mean, that does make a difference. Then.
It does. If there are liens and penalties. If it's just liens, then that's less of a burden. But nonetheless, the legislature would not hardly have chosen to impose a lien on all of an employer's property while the litigation is going on. If this wasn't something pretty egregious, if the employer isn't almost presumed to have done something wrong. And that's the type of thing we're looking at with this prompt payment statute. As I note, it's been characterized by every court that has looked at this statute, including the U.S. Supreme Court.
Could I please ask you a question? The state has sovereign immunity.
Correct.
I thought I understood you in answering a question to say that if your wages were not paid, that you could go into federal court. You could go into state court.
To circuit court.
Circuit court.
My wages were not paid promptly.
Yeah.
If it was clearly a wage claim under the statute, We all know what wages I'm supposed to be paid. That same, it varies, flips back and forth, but it's depending on deductions, but we know what that amount is, each paycheck, and they simply refuse to issue the paycheck time and time again. Then I have the ability to go into court and file under the wage claim law.
So that the state, with its sovereign immunity, has granted permission for state employees to sue. And has that been the state's position all the way through?
The state's immunity has been waived as against wage claim statutes. I believe that's been the position we've noted. If I'm in error on that, I stand corrected. But my understanding is we have consistently said, as to claims that are clearly under this statute, the state, the legislature has said the state is an employer. A claim can be made. The problem is, when we're getting out on the fringes of what may or may not be within this statute, and I think that's one of the problems. We don't have to decide what are those fringes and what is inside the fringes and not in this case. We don't have to decide here what 109, the actual parameters of what 109 does and doesn't cover. All we need to do, because the state's immunity is involved, is look and see, did the legislature clearly, unequivocally, and expressly allow these particular claims to be made against the state in court?
Can I ask this? This case involves claims by the troopers for their lunch hour.
Right.
Suppose there were a decision by the appropriate state agency involving the deputies for the Dane County Sheriff's Department under identical circumstances, and there had been a ruling in favor of the deputies. That doesn't apply to the troopers, but suppose there was that precedent. Could the troopers sue then?
It could be, but let me couch that with this. With that 12-factor test that we're involved with on lunch breaks being in or out, I would suggest it's a very fact-intensive inquiry, and it would be very hard to say, here we have this situation in which these similar people have been allowed lunch breaks, therefore the same thing occurs here. I would wager once we got down to the facts, we'd find a lot of disparities, which would make it a little more difficult to apply that. Go ahead.
Counsel, the Court of Appeals decision in this case viewed the function of 09 as differently than you. They looked at it and said, look, under 109, an employee can bring a claim for wages due. These are wages due, and you can bring the claim, and then looked under sub 5 and said, and you don't have to bring it first in the agency. That's the way they interpreted wages due. What state court decision can you cite to that interprets wages due the way you do? I'm talking about 109.03 sub 5.
While I'm looking, I will note that the Court of Appeals also said twice, we can't clearly find plaintiff's claims within this statute. You've got to look at legislative history, but I'll continue looking for it.
So I'm interested in state court authority.
Certainly.
This Court of Appeals is contrary to you. What state court authority?
On pages 43 through 44 of our initial brief, we cite six Wisconsin cases which have interpreted 109, and at least as I read them, all point to the purpose of the statute being the prompt payment of wages, not the resolution of wage disputes such as this. The whole idea is, and for example, in employees local, they were looking at two different statutes. That was 146728. They were looking at two different statutes, and eventually the court said, wait a minute. I'm sorry. The Court of Appeals, in its initial decision, which was affirmed, indicated the employer conduct was not the type of conduct meant to be penalized under 109. And then this court looked at the two statutes and said, we really have to kind of narrowly construe this wage payment law because of the penalty provisions.
What was the other statute?
I can't recall right now. I'm sorry.
I can understand you're talking about the Fair Employment Statute.
Mm-hmm.
And discrimination and whether or not comparable work should have been applied, etc. And that you're really under fair employment and it does affect wages. And then when you look at the two statutes in harmony, you might say that the fair employment one takes precedent. I can understand that. But is that true in all of these cases? I'm sorry, I'm just not familiar with all of them.
Sure.
I mean, is it true in all of them that you got another statute or another kind of provision?
Oh, the six cases noted there,
yeah,
that's the only one I think that involved comparison between two statutes. The otherwise, they were looking at 109 itself, as I recall. And
yeah,
in that, pages 43 and 44. And in that context, they each, for example, Kenosha firefighters saying explicitly, using the purpose is to obtain the prompt payment of wages which are due, and they italicized wages which are due.
No, but what was the fight about there?
In Kenosha firefighters, as I recall, I think they were, as I recall, 109 was being looked at not directly, but for some purpose. I would have to read the case. I apologize for not having that.
Well, I don't have it either, so we're in the same position. But I did look at the definition of wage.
Mm-hmm.
Wage means, this is with 109.01, wage means remuneration payable to an employee for personal services, including salary, commission, holiday, and vacation to pay, overtime, severance, or dismissal, supplemental, etc. So that is nothing. But perhaps you would like to get to the sovereign immunity issue.
I would appreciate it. Quickly, overtime is mentioned. If overtime is due to me in that paycheck and it's not paid time and time again, I can go into court if we have a dispute over whether it should be at all. That's another matter. That's in hours and work. The point with state's immunity is the people set up a structure where the state could not be sued, with one narrow exception, and that is where the legislature clearly, unequivocally, and expressly states the state may be sued on these claims, these type of claims. That's the way this court has consistently interpreted the constitutional provision. The judiciary has one role regarding the state's immunity, and that is to rigorously enforce it, except where it finds that clear, express, and unequivocal language. It's possible that the result might be different if I stood before you as the attorney for a private employer. But I don't. I stand before you as the attorney for the state, and the state may not be sued in this or any other manner, unless we have that type of clear, unequivocal, and express consent. Now, when the appellate court looks at this statute and says, gee, we can't tell whether or not these claims are allowed under 109 twice, and then consults legislative history to try to figure that out, how can we have clear, express, and unequivocal consent from the legislature to allow these claims against the state? That The fact that the appellate court got to that point and reached that conclusion should have been the end of the inquiry. That should have done it. Sorry, we cannot overcome the state's immunity. There's no reason to interpret what the legislature did and to try to figure it out, as often is the case in statutory construction. A court's job is to figure out what the legislature was doing. That's not what's going on here. It is simply a matter of looking at the statute and carefully considering its language, and if a judge has to wonder, after that careful consideration, whether or not the state's immunity was waived, it was not. How could, I must say that we're not as concerned about prevailing in this case. We feel that we'd be able to, if we had to proceed to court, prevail on the merits. But I am deeply concerned about the rationale used by the appellate court and in a public decision, because it's the rationale that will cause far more damage over time to the state's immunity than any result in this particular case. It's the rationale that we suggest really does need to be corrected, particularly where we have concepts such as, which was not applicable at all in this case and not even briefed by the parties, the concept that the phrase, sue and be sued in an agency's power, can somehow waive the state's immunity as to that agency, completely waive it as to any suit against that agency. That's a concept that we ask really needs to be corrected so that it doesn't wreak further havoc. It already has in the Meeson case and in the Butzloff case. That's a concept we would ask really needs to be corrected.
Would you ask us to overrule the Meeson case and Butzloff case then with regard to that language, interpreting Barr and relying on this case?
Meeson is before the court on a petition for review that has been stayed pending this case. We request that it would be wise to simply reverse based on assuming that the court, if the court should reverse here, that it would accept review in Meeson, either take up the separate issues or reverse in Meeson on that basis. As to Butzloff, as we've argued, that's dicta. However, it's there, and it can wreak havoc. And under the State v. Sarton precedent, we'd ask that the court correct that dicta so it doesn't create further.
In fact, in Butzloff, you had asked, you had, as you note in your brief, difficulty because you were the prevailing party, but you asked the Court of Appeals to get rid of that language, and they declined.
They declined to do so. So the message I get from that, though dicta, they intend to continue using it unless corrected.
Counsel,
yes?
So I understand your argument. In response to Justice Prosser, you said that if this were a wage claim under 109, Chapter 109, then the state can be sued in circuit court. There is no sovereign immunity. Is that correct?
If it meets all the criteria for being a wage claim and is, and in trying to determine whether it's a wage claim allowable against the state, I think you do have to look at comprehensive alternative remedies such as the ones that are available. Now, what I'm saying is, if it's a wage claim, there's a range of activity that may fall within a wage claim. I don't know that we have that fixed and we have to have it fixed, but if it's clearly within the wage claim and not covered by any other statute, then yes, we can proceed.
There's no sovereign immunity.
The state, I believe, as to wage claims clearly within that statute, has waived sovereign immunity.
So, you were writing this opinion, the first issue you'd have to decide is whether this was a wage claim or not.
Not necessarily.
No, why not?
I think the first thing that the court would have to do, and perhaps the only thing the court would have to do, is to look at the language of these two statutes and decide, can we say that the legislature has clearly, unequivocally, and expressly said these plaintiff's claims may be pursued under the wage claim law. If you answer that question no, then that's the end of the case.
It's your position, counsel, that if this were the type of wage claim with wages due, as you define it, then there is no immunity under 109. Is that correct?
It's my own reading of it. I stand to be corrected, but it's my own reading of it. And I have several people before me that can certainly look at the statute better than I. But that's my view. Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Davey, representing Joan German et al.
Your Honors, I'm Bruce Davey. I'm a lawyer with the law firm of Lawton & Cates in Madison. I represent Joan German, Arnold Merkel, and Brian Virgin, all of whom are state patrol officers. As was noted earlier, this is an action basically involving a claim that so many restrictions are placed upon the troopers' use of the half-hour meal break in their eight-and-a-half-hour daily schedule, that the meal break constitutes time worked, and that therefore the troopers are to be compensated. The complaint set forth a variety of restrictions that are placed upon the troopers' use of the meal break period. They're not enabled to engage in personal business. They must remain in full uniform. They must abide by all of the policies that are applicable to them during working time, including prohibitions on such things as smoking, and regulations of their conduct. They're not enabled to take their meal breaks at any time they choose, or any place they choose, or with anyone they choose. They're required to remain in contact with the
Counsel,
state.
If I could interrupt for a minute, the merits of that argument aren't really before us on this
That's correct.
Petition for review. Why didn't you go to the agency first?
I didn't go to the agency first because I felt that commencing an action in state court was the quickest and most expeditious way of getting this matter resolved.
Any other practical advantages, procedural advantages, or theoretical advantages to join a court first?
What, in my experience, filing a claim, a wage claim, with the administrative agency basically puts you on hold for 6 to 8 months. They look at it, don't do anything, don't make any determination, and ultimately direct you to go ahead and proceed with a court action if you wish to pursue the claim. The other alternative is for the agency to have the district attorney pursue the claim, which is done in some circumstances. The most efficient way, in my judgment, to bring the issue that this case involved to a head was to commence an action in circuit court.
Was there any interpretive focus to that decision? In other words, based upon your experience or knowledge of how the agency decides these lunch break payment issues?
My experience is that they don't decide them.
They don't decide them at all. They don't reach the merits.
They don't have hearings on matters like this. This isn't like going through a fair employment practice case. If you go to the agency, they just look at it and basically tell you, we think that you have a claim, and direct you to proceed in court or direct the district attorney to pursue it.
What is your definition of wages due under this statute?
Well, wages is defined in 109 as remuneration payable to an employee for personal services. Wages due are what amount is to be paid to the employee for the work that they perform.
Well, you have to continue reading, though, on that definition, don't you? Wages are defined as remuneration payable to an employee for personal services, etc., when required under a binding collective bargaining agreement, bonuses and any other similar advantage agreed upon between the employer and the employee or provided by the employer to the employees as an established policy. So you've either got to be entitled to these wages pursuant to a collective bargaining agreement if you're unionized, right?
Correct.
Or you've got to be entitled to these wages pursuant to some other contract or agreement between you and the employer, right?
Sure.
Or you've got to be entitled to these as a matter of some policy that the employer has put in place unilaterally to authorize the payment of these wages. And we don't have any of those in this case, do we?
Sure you do. There is a collective bargaining agreement.
Does it call for payment of meal times?
The collective bargaining agreement calls for, it doesn't specifically address that.
Okay. And is there any other agreement in place between these particular employees and the employer authorizing payment for meal breaks?
The collective bargaining agreement incorporates the provisions of the Fair Labor Standards Act, which includes the payment of on-duty meal breaks. So it's incorporated through the collective bargaining agreement. There's also the administrative rule through the Department of Workforce Development 27402 that provides that if it's an on-duty meal of a half hour, it's to be paid. If the employee is not free of work,
who's to make the determination if whether or not under this multifaceted test this constitutes on-duty versus off-duty meals as an initial matter?
The circuit court.
Okay, so that's the position you're taking here. The agency has no role in that whatsoever, or the...
No, you could go to the agency and ask the agency to look at the claim to determine whether they thought it was on-duty or off-duty. But there wouldn't be an administrative hearing on the matter, and they would direct you either that they thought you had a claim or you didn't have a claim, and you would pursue it in circuit court.
So they would say, yes, we think this is on duty and you should be paid for it, so either we'll sue or you can go ahead and sue?
Correct.
Okay.
Counsel, let me just ask you a question. Does that language in defining wages when required under a binding collective agreement cover everything? Does it cover salaries? Or does that language only cover the last issue, the last...
I don't have the full language right in front of me, Your Honor, so I'm not...
Well, I'm wanting to know whether or not wages have to be under collective bargaining agreements or an established policy.
I don't think so. I mean, the employment relationship is a contractual relationship, and it's typically an oral contract. The employee works for the employer. Typically, their employment is terminable at will, and there is an oral agreement with regard to what the rate of compensation is.
You think that's covered under Chapter 109?
I do, yes.
Okay. That's
basically the whole private sector is that way, except for those private employees who are organized.
Okay. I have another question. I looked at the legislative history of Chapter 109, and it was established in 1975, and it repealed a wage claim and collection law which gave the Department of Industry, Labor, and Human Relations the authority to enforce, adjust, and take assignments of wage claims. So it seemed to put more in the court. Now, I did not go back beyond that. Can you give us some legislative history?
Actually, the Court of Appeals decision deals with the legislative history, and until 1975, the right to sue was contained in Chapter 103. It was Section 103.39, and that section did permit an employee to pursue a claim in court. And in 1975, that language was removed and was placed in Chapter 109.
So you're saying it retained that.
Correct. And if you look at the notes at the bottom of the statutes and the laws in 1975, it says this basically continues what we had in 103.39.
It seemed to me it gave the department less power.
There was an amendment after that, that in 1993, that I wouldn't say gave them less power. Maintained the status quo. Okay. And then in 1993, it was made clear that an employee could commence an action without even filing a wage claim.
So, counsel, just so I think you've made your argument clear so that I understand it, what you're saying in summary about, and I guess I'll refer to it as exhausting any administrative remedies, that really under 103 and I think it's 274, there really was no reason to go there. You could have started right with 109.035 because you had concept wages due, and other than the fact that DWD and the statute does not require that this should have come before them. That's what you're saying. You looked at the alternatives here and you thought, well, we'll go right to court. First of all, it's quicker, and we do not have to exhaust our whatever administrative procedure there. We don't have to go that route.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay.
And with regard to representing individuals who have had wage claims since 1969, I've never filed a claim with used to be Diller, now it's the Department of Workforce Development, because that was not an expeditious way to get the matter resolved. You went to court.
Could I ask, this is a little strange question, but can troopers brown bag at lunchtime? Can they bring their own lunch?
Yes.
Can they drop off laundry?
That would be personal business.
Even if it was right next door to a restaurant?
That's my understanding. I mean, we've been so bogged down in the sovereign immunity thing. It's been some time since we've looked at what the regulations are on all of their conduct.
But that's not before us either.
That's not before us.
But the only thing before us is if you can continue in the circuit court.
Correct.
Now, so is it your understanding and the basis of your brief that if this is a wage claim under 109.035, and the elders were just, that they're not claiming sovereign immunity?
That's my understanding, but, you never know. What I call weasel words. It appears, sort of thing. But that's what the brief seems to state.
Well, then, one of the things you should be arguing, I think, but maybe I'm just misunderstanding this case, is why is it or isn't it within 109.03?
I'm sorry.
Why is this a wage claim?
It's a wage claim because they have actually worked and are entitled to be compensated for the time they worked at the rate that they are customarily paid.
Well, that's what you say. The state says, let's just suppose the state is saying, no, they're not entitled to be paid for that. So now we got to fight. As I understand the state position, once you have a fight, it's not a claim for wages due on each regular pay day.
And then what is it?
Counsel comes under 103. You got to go to the department.
Well, clearly a dispute about if the employer says, well, I don't think you worked on Friday, or you're not entitled to holiday pay because you didn't work the day before, and in fact you did work the day before. I mean, there are innumerable kinds of situations in which there can be a dispute. An employer typically pays the employee unless there's some dispute about whether they worked or not.
But to get there, to get to 109, you have to clearly have wages due. I mean, that's what the dispute is about. And I'm just not sure. Just repeat again why you think these wages, it's so clear that these wages are due.
Because under the law, these people worked
right
that half hour. And under the regulations, it says that they shall be paid. The Administrative Rules, Department of Workforce Development, 27402, says that you're to be paid for that
half
hour. And I guess
that, sorry to interrupt, but that's why I'm saying, well, if it's under 274, then shouldn't, that would be the place you start, but you're saying, no, they've already said that, that's the rule, that's why we jump into 109.
Correct.
Not going back to the administrative agency.
Correct.
Counsel, your opposing counsel points to pages, I think it is 43 and 44 of his initial brief, for cases which stand for the proposition, it's argued, that wages due,
his definition of wages.
There is no dispute about some certain amount for wages due. I hope I correctly said that. There's no dispute. Are the cases that he's citing standing for his definition of wages due?
Not in my opinion.
Well, tell me more then.
two of these cases involve the application of collective bargaining. Situations arising out of the negotiation of a collective bargaining agreement where the negotiations ended up in arbitration and the arbitrator selected what the wages were to be in the collective bargaining agreement, and they involved a fight over whether the employer delayed the payment of the wages that were ordered in by the arbitrator. And what the court did basically was harmonize the 111. It's 111. Municipal sector with the Wage Payment Act. Two of the cases involve that, and they don't get to the issue that the state asserts they stand for on what's a wage due. There is one case involving an employee whose employment was terminated, and the employee contended that they were entitled to and basically it's like a discharge case and that they were entitled to further payments into the future because it wasn't just cause to terminate their employment, and the case turned on whether the claim was for services rendered under the definition of what a wage was, and said, no, your claim, you didn't actually work. You're seeking, in essence, a form of liquidated damages for having your employment terminated, and that's not the kind of claim that's provided for in 109. So that basically, none of those cases deal with the question of whether, in fact, there is a dispute about whether wages were due or not due, or liquidated or unliquidated.
strikes me that maybe the key language in the Court of Appeals decision that has to be, that is before us, is the question we face here is whether an employee may sue an employer under 109.035, the wage claim, that derives from Administrative Code 274, without first pursuing the claim before the department. The department contends that the officer's claim is not properly brought under 109 because it has to be determined by the DOT.
That's
first. And that's the kicker issue.
Right.
Because once you find that it's a wage claim under 109, you don't have to ever get to sovereign immunity.
Correct.
So why isn't the department right that anything that comes under 103.02 has to go to the department first?
Because 103.005, parent 14A, says that they administer and enforce the chapter so far as not otherwise provided in the statutes.
But give that to me again.
That's section 103.005, parent 14, parent A. And 109 is the successor to 103.39, which gave employees the right to pursue a wage claim.
And that was under the 1975 laws.
That was pre-1975.
Okay.
And so you don't have 109 was extracted in large part from 103 and incorporated with some other provisions, but the key provisions as relate to this case came from Chapter 103, which is consistent with what we believe is the plain language of 109. And the agency, I would note, the agency itself has said that under Rule 274.07, that the penalties for violation of 274.02, which is the meal provision, include the penalties in 109.11.
Counsel, in your brief, as I recall it, you don't mention or address this whole BAHR dispute. Maybe you cite it someplace, but in terms of consent, you know, to sue or be sued, why don't you address that?
I mean, I had no quarrel. I got a brief from Mr. Moriarty that's 50 pages long. The bulk of it is a recitation of the history of sovereign immunity, about which I frankly cared very little. I mean, I thought the principle was there was sovereign immunity unless the legislature clearly and expressly said there wasn't. And I read the statute and it's 109, and it seemed to me that was as clear an expression of a waiver of sovereign immunity as you're ever going to find. And I'm not arguing in this case that the Department of Transportation is some separate entity with proprietary rights or whatever. I mean, it really had no application as far as I was concerned.
The Court of Appeals, however, discussed that.
I understand.
And you took a different tact from the Court of Appeals, I think. Two questions. Number one, did you take a different tact than the Court of Appeals? And number two, if you did, how would you distinguish your position from the Court of Appeals' position?
I wouldn't say that I took a different tact. I've used different language. You know, I found no need to discuss sue or be sued. I think that the language to sue or be sued was used in there because the language in the wage statute is so broad. And the court was kind of analogizing to language in other cases where the language was broad.
You, as I recall it, also didn't find the need to harmonize 103 and 109. Is that correct or incorrect? I mean, am I recalling it correctly?
I mean, I think they are harmonized. I think 109 was derived from 103. The key provision was pulled right out of 103. I don't see them as distinct schemes. They're part of one mechanism to enable employees to get relief from employers who don't pay them properly. Asked us to address the notice of claim, the application of the notice of claim statute. We're both in agreement that it doesn't apply, and unless there were some further questions on that, I don't have anything further.
Is there an injunctive action against the individuals? What's your position on that?
I included the individuals under my 1983 claim. I think that the circuit court would have the ability to issue declaratory injunctive relief against the individuals without the filing of the notice of claim.
Under 1983?
No, under the state law.
But that's not before us.
There are many decisions, sir, under 274.02 are there reported decisions that really make this an unequivocal win for you when you get this decided?
Not under LURC. There were a number of decisions under the Fair Labor Standards Act. Federal courts dealing with the issue under the federal law that would indicate we should prevail.
Is there anything directly on point?
Not on the state side.
Thank you, counsel. It's my understanding that that's either a testing or it's error. So that is the alarm. So we will continue under that understanding.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel?
On that question, the Barfield case, Barefield, from the Seventh Circuit is probably the central case on the meal break issue itself. There's not really any state authority on the meal break issue. It is handled by the DWD. And there's not written decisions that clarify it at all. And as I indicated before, our view is we prevail on the merits. Their view is they prevail on the merits. So that's why there's attorneys.
Well, I'd like to ask you,
yes.
and I have a serious purpose in asking you this question. How much slack is there in the implementation of the work rules? I mean, for example, I asked Mr. Davey about whether a trooper could deliver laundry during the lunch break, particularly if the laundry was right next to a restaurant. And he said, no. Now, what's going to happen?
I must say, unfortunately, this case comes in on a motion to dismiss, and that's a... I investigated some and looked at some things, but I can't say I'm in intimate, detailed knowledge of the facts to know what the answer to that would be. I just can't tell you. This case stopped at the point that the motions to dismiss were made, and I can't give you that information, unfortunately.
For purposes of our review, we have to take the allegations on a motion to dismiss as true.
Precisely the case. And obviously, motion to dismiss denied, they have to prove the allegations. But for your purposes, all those allegations are true. That's what we're operating on. Counsel says he didn't go to the agency because it would be more expeditious to go to court. They first filed federal overtime claims in federal court. Those were dismissed based on the state immunity by agreement. He then filed federal FLSA claims in state court. Those were dismissed based on the state's immunity. He then pursued these state law claims. And those have been challenged based on state immunity, and it's been a long time. There's no evidence in the record that the agency proceeding is anything less than expeditious.
When you say, counsel, they were dismissed on state immunity, really it was deferring to the state courts to address the issues of their own immunity, wasn't it?
Not actually. In the federal court, when claims are made against a state, the 11th Amendment to the United States Constitution comes into play, and those claims are dismissed based on the 11th Amendment.
Would you cite the Alden versus Maine case, and that seems to me to be a couple hundred pages of reading. So the pages that I did read suggest that, kind of the new federalism sort of approach to it. We're going to let the state courts address the issues of their own immunity.
Seminole Tribe is the U.S. Supreme Court case that involves federal courts and says you cannot pursue essentially FLSA claims in federal court.
But you can in state court.
It did not say that, but then Alden said you may not pursue them in state court either. So it was the dropping the other shoe a few years later. Seminole Tribe was dealing with a federal court action, so it just talked about federal court and didn't talk about state court. Alden dealt with state court, therefore talked about state court.
Counsel, I asked your opposing counsel on the exhausting of administrative remedies, looking at 103, 274. What is, and I was looking through your argument, we haven't really touched on that a great deal. What do you feel that you heard his answer, there's absolutely no need to go under 103. What is your position?
My position is if all claims that could be made under the hours of work and overtime law can instead be brought by employees under the wage claim statute, why do we have the separate statute? Why did the legislature create a separate statute?
But he said all? It's meaningless. He said that in his experience, he's never done that, and they're not going to do anything anyway.
And I will suggest respectfully, he noted he's never filed a claim with the department. So I doubt that it's coming from personal experience on whether it is expeditious or not.
So there is a substantive decision-making adjudicative process at the agency level on these claims, which resolves these disputes one way or another, and then depending upon the decision, the claim is either settled or it goes to court, right?
As I understand it, and looking at the statute again based on my understanding, there's an investigation that takes place, and parties can obtain a hearing. It isn't always done, and it's certainly not as formalized as you'll see under the Fair Employment Act, but hearings are available. Once decisions are made by the department, then there's judicial review available under the statute. So it is a comprehensive enforcement scheme created by the legislature for these claims.
Well, I noticed that 103.05.5.6F talks about hearings before the department in which a hearing is sought, and all hearings of the department shall be open to the public. So that's just what I...
Yes.
That was the reason for my question.
And that's one of the problems with the Court of Appeals decision. They said, we don't have to look at this as any type of enforcement scheme because it doesn't provide for hearings and it doesn't provide for judicial review. It provides for both. The 103 scheme provides for both.
And the judicial review is subject to a de novo standard of review in the circuit court or no?
It would not be de novo. It would be under the same judicial review standards as workers' comp claims, employment discrimination claims,
anywhere.
All sorts of claims that involve wages that plaintiffs claim to be due.
So it's the judicial review that pertains to any other administrative agency decision, which is deferential to the agency, correct?
Correct.
So there is the theoretical and practical advantage to starting in the circuit court as opposed to starting in the agency, which gets back to my original question.
Yes, yes, there is a strategic reason to do so if one believes...
it's going to go against you?
It's going to go against you in the agency, or you feel you might get a better shake in court. There might be some strategic reasons to do that. The central point I would point out again, though, is not what this stat is encompassed, not what wage claims are encompassed in the statute, but what is clearly expressly and unequivocally allowed against the state.
Chief, may I ask a question of clarification?
Is your position then that that the DWD is exclusive, or is your argument that it should be the primary? You go there first before the claim, are those both the same argument?
On claims covered by the hours of work and overtime statute, they are the exclusive remedy. That's the presumption when you have a comprehensive remedy. Under this court's clear law, that's the presumption that this is a comprehensive remedy. It is exclusive of all others as to those claims. Now, at some point, something that has previously been litigated as a claim under the hours of work law, through a DWD order that is not complied with, could become a wage claim that could be pursued under 109. That's, I think, when it would come into play. But it's not a matter of exhausting the hours of work and then going in.
So your argument is
exclusive. Structure. Exclusive and a separate statutory structure. Yes. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Davey. We are in recess until 1:45. The students and anyone else who wishes to be here to discuss the Supreme Court.